question that we are looking at the end part of chapter 6 going into all of chapter 7. And, you know, that's just one, it's one narrative. And, you know, my heart was really, as I'm studying it, just there's so much here. You know, it's almost like you could just break it down into a couple of verses, kind of teach on that, and another couple of verses and teach on that. And, but, you know, it's one sermon. So we're actually going to dissect a sermon this morning, and it's Stephen's sermon. And so I want to remind you before we get into the text that the one of the key points of the book of Acts is that the mission of God through Jesus to this world isn't over. So it didn't finish when, you know, either Jesus was crucified or whether when Jesus was risen from the dead or when he ascended. It didn't finish then. They were just transition points, if you like. The ascension was really so that he could send the Holy Spirit. And I want us to look at just a couple of things. We're not going to probably pull them out in great detail because, again, we don't have time. But if you're taking notes, just make a note of some of these things about how much we need the Holy Spirit, how much we need Jesus working in us through the Holy Spirit to be able to live the kind of life that he calls us to live. Because I don't know if any of you have discovered this, but sometimes this life is just too hard, right? And things are just too, just crazy sometimes. And, you know, we need the Holy Spirit. And then would you just notice that? And then also would you make a note of the fact that how God just sometimes takes us around the long way to teach us that dependence. And we'll chat a little bit about that as well. But we're going to talk about Stephen, and we're talking about the full story of God, because Jesus continues his work today. He hasn't finished his work. He's continuing his work. He does so by drawing people to himself, by converting people, and then empowering people to live out the life that they've been called to live. That's what Jesus does. He draws people, he converts people, and he empowers people by his Holy Spirit. And he gives them a calling. And so we see this in our text. We see a portrait of one man who has been drawn, he has been called, and he's been empowered, not just to live, but also then to die. And so, you know, you have to live for Christ before you get to die for Christ. You'll never die for Christ if you can't live for Christ. And so what we'll see is what happens to someone when they're then empowered to be faithful to that call, to live for Christ and then to die for Christ. And so we pick up the story in verse 9 of chapter 6. And you remember that there's been a few waves of persecution that have come through, affected the church, the early church at this point. And the apostles have been hurled into prison. They've been told not to speak about Jesus. They've been beaten up just for good measure. And they've gone right back to the temple and said, well, let me tell you about Jesus. And they've carried on preaching. They've carried on talking about Jesus. And so we get to verse 9 in our story. Then some of those who belonged to the synagogue of the freedmen, as it was called. So just pause there. There were some Jews who they had earned their Roman citizenship through service to Rome. They weren't, you know, born in Rome. They were born outside of Rome. They weren't born in one of the Roman cities outside of Rome. So they had to earn their citizenship through service. And when they had finished their service, they had come back to Jerusalem and formed a little club called the Libertines. Now, that's not like a 1990s rock band, right? I mean, it is, but it's not the same 1990s rock band. They're the Libertines. And they were a group of freed Jews. Free Jews who had earned Roman status. And so it says that those guys, along with some of Cyrenians and Alexandrians, who are both from kind of North Africa, and those from Cilicia and Asia, rose up and disputed with Stephen. And so this seems to be one synagogue for all of these groups of people. who weren't, Jews from Israel. They were Jews from somewhere else, not permitted to be in the synagogues of the Jews, but a separate synagogue for those people who are outside or who hailed from outside of Israel. And look, we know that it's probably likely that Paul belonged to this synagogue, Saul belonged to this synagogue, because we're told in Acts 21 that he said, I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia. And so the synagogue that Paul would have been permitted to go to in Jerusalem would have been this synagogue, the synagogue that belonged to all of these people who were from outside of Israel. And so quite likely, where it says that some arose and came to dispute with Stephen, quite likely Paul is one of those disputing with Stephen. Now, we know later in the text that Paul was there. Saul, he was there holding the coats of those people who stoned him. And if you want to, and I would encourage you to, it's quite a lengthy study, but I would encourage you to try and do this, is to look at Paul's sermons and Paul's writings. And they all harken back to this one sermon of Stephen. Even in fact, when he says in Romans chapter 8, verse 18, he talks about how I consider that the sufferings of this present world aren't, they can't be compared to the glory that is coming. Even that, we see that in our text this morning. And so, whenever Paul is teaching, and we see it from his sermons in Acts, they all come from this one sermon of Stephen. And so plagiarism, yeah, if you like, but it's a good one. So perhaps Paul is here, they're disputing with Stephen, but it says in verse 10 that they could not withstand the wisdom and the spirit with which he was speaking, and they became angry. And so they secretly instigated men and said, we have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and God. So these are the same kind of accusations that came against Jesus. They pulled in guys, they paid some guys off to lie in about Jesus, and they're doing the same thing now again. So this is a similar trait that they have got themselves into. And they stirred up the people, verse 12, and the elders and the scribes, and they came upon him and seized him and brought him before the council, just as they did with Jesus. And they set up false witness, as they did with Jesus. Can you see the kind of similarities going on? Who said, this man never ceases to speak words against this holy place and the law, for we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy the place. Remember, that's one of the accusations that they brought against Jesus, against the temple. And so they will change... that will change the customs of that Moses has delivered to us. Verse 15, and gazing at him, all who sat in the council. And so imagine that the council is like a semicircle on two levels, 35 seats in the bottom, 35 seats in the top. And they are gazing at him. And it says that all who sit in the council saw that his face was like the face of an angel. Now, what I think that means is that his just face was glowing. I mean, I don't think it had like many sides and many eyes, as we get descriptions of angels in the Old Testament. I don't think his face was transformed to that degree. I think it's the same kind of glowing that Moses had. This is a glowing face, if you like. And it says there in verse 1 that the high priest, and so this is Caiaphas, the high priest, the same guy who'd been in charge of the trial of Jesus, all right? So, Paul talked about if we suffer with Christ, don't be surprised when we suffer the same things that Jesus went through. And here, this is almost like a repeat thing, word for word, of what's happening. Caiaphas is in charge. And he says there in verse 1, are these things so? And Stephen answered in verse 2, and what we now find in the rest of this chapter, in chapter 7, is Stephen is about to give us the longest and most articulate sermon ever recorded. So you think my sermons are long? Stephen's is the longest sermon recorded in Acts. It's the most articulate sermon recorded in Acts. He uses 15 words in this sermon are found nowhere else in the New Testament. All right. This guy he's trained. I mean, he's a smart guy. It's twice as long, the sermon, as the sermon that was delivered by Peter at Pentecost. And you will know if you've read this. This is just the model of sermons. And just as an overview to this, because we're not going to pick it apart, point by point. But just as an overview, there are two main themes that run through this sermon. And they are an answer to the two accusations that have come against him. So two themes that run through, and they're really in response to the two accusations that have come to Stephen. So it's almost like Stephen is building up a case, to prove not only his own innocence, but also their own guilt. And by the time we get to, I guess, about verse 50, the tables have been turned and he's not the accuser. He's not the accused. They are. And they're on the back foot. And so this is what Stephen says is the first accusation. And it comes from verse 13 of chapter 6. They set up false witnesses, as they did with Jesus. They set up false witnesses. This man never ceases to speak words against the holy place and the law. So that's the first accusation, that Stephen is coming and he's speaking against the temple, speaking against Jerusalem, and he's speaking against the Mosaic law that they were accustomed to. And so they accuse him of this. And now I think the context is really important, because to you and me, in our culture, in our day, that's not a big, it's not a big deal, is it, to be accused of that? But certainly in the first century and in first century Judaism, it's huge, because they believed that the way to worship God, and the only way to worship God, according to the Jew, was that it is tied to the land and tied to the law. That you can't worship God unless it was tied to the land and tied to the law. Even today, God's presence and God's blessing is tied to the land. If you want a very, very basic understanding of what's happening in the Middle East, it's this. You've got two groups of people and some more groups of people who both believe that God's presence is restricted to the land, the dirt. And that's the basic overview of what's happening in the Middle East, is that you've got one group of people that are saying God's presence resides here on this dirt. And you've got another group and several other groups of people are saying, no, our God resides on this dirt. And that's why they're fighting over the dirt. It's not that the dirt is important. It's that God's presence resides on that dirt. You remember when, you see this in the Old Testament, the story of Nahum in 2 Kings. You remember the story, he's the commander of the armies of Syria, and he's gone to Israel to seek healing for his leprosy, and he finds Elisha, and Elisha tells him to go wash in the Jordan, and he does so, and he's healed of his leprosy. And as Nahum is about to depart back to Syria, he went to Elisha and he says something like this. He says, "Now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel." And he kind of like, okay, well, we get that. But then he gives instructions to load up two buckets full of dirt on his donkey to take him back to Syria. Why? Because they believed that God's presence resided over the dirt. And if we could take the dirt back to Syria, guess who else they're taking back to Syria? God. And so the big thing with Judaism throughout the centuries is this idea that you can't worship God unless you're on the land, on the dirt of Israel. And specifically in Jerusalem, and even more specifically on this mound of dirt called the Temple Mount. And so, in one sense, their accusation of Stephen is absolutely correct. It's absolutely right. Because this worship, which was geographically defined, was rooted in the law of Moses. So denying this kind of worship was questioning the law of Moses, unquestionably. And so Stephen is now going to lead his accusers on this journey through their own history. And by doing so, he's going to highlight this one essential concept. And for you taking notes, I'm going to say it a couple of times so you can get it down. And this is the essential concept that Stephen is trying to get across. He's saying this, that the history of Israel bears out the fact that the life of the Jews was spent, much of the life of the Jews was spent outside of Israel and not inside of Israel. So what that means is that the land isn't essential for the worship of God. So let me just kind of say that again. I know some of you are frantically taking notes and I went a little bit too far. So the history of Israel, this is what Stephen's going to kind of highlight for us, going to go back into history. The history of Israel bears out the fact that much of the life of the Jews was spent outside of the land and not inside of the land. And because it was spent outside of the land, the worship of God isn't tied to the land. And this is, of course, you know, something that Jesus demonstrated and Jesus said in John chapter 4, didn't he? He's having that conversation with the woman at the well in Samaria of all places. And they have this conversation about where is the right place to worship God. Is it on Mount Gerizim or is it on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem? And Jesus says this in John chapter 4, verse 20. He says, our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. Right? So the Samaritan said, Mount Gerizim. The Jew said, no, it's on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now he is now here, when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. And so the temple, even through Jesus's teaching, is the temple is set aside for a time at least. The temple is being set aside as the only place of worship, of the worship of God. And so the customs of Moses is absolutely true. The customs of Moses are being altered. And so that's the first kind of theme that runs through this. And then the second theme that runs through this sermon from verse 14 is where Stephen is accused of threatening to change the customs of Moses that Moses delivered to us. And Stephen answers this then by telling the Sanhedrin, this council, that the glorious past, and this is actually quite, you know, funny for us to read, it's humorous for us to read, that and for us to understand that the glorious past of Israel isn't that glorious. Right? That's what he's going to say. And that's why they're going to get so mad. The Sanhedrin are like, oh, Israel, the glorious history of Israel. And Stephen's going to go, let me tell you about a glorious history of Israel. Ain't that glorious? And they're going to get mad at that. Israel wasn't this marvelously obedient nation. They had proved themselves time and time again to be rebels against Moses and against the law which was given through them. So it's quite hilarious then that the Sanhedrin are going, oh, Stephen, we're accusing you of misrepresenting Moses and talking about going against the law. And Stephen's going to go, let me remind you about Israel's history, about obeying the Mosaic law. It's not all that glorious. And so he's going to tell them a couple of truths. And even, you know, after Moses, they rebelled, didn't they? Time and time again. And God had to rescue them. And that's why, even in Hosea, Israel is painted as a prostitute, as an adulterous woman against God, not as a faithful wife, but as a prostitute. And so rather than Stephen really offer much of a defense, he's going to tell them some truths about their glorious past and how their fathers met God far from Jerusalem, right? And by the time we get to verse 50, the tables are turned, and it's not Stephen being accused, it's the religious leaders of Israel. And so let's go through this sermon, this wonderful sermon by Stephen. This is what he says. He says, brothers and fathers. Great way to start. A sermon, he's being accused. He's not going up to them and poking them in the eye straight away. He wants to lure them in, you know. And he's like, hey, brothers, fathers, hear me. The God of glory appeared to our father, Abraham, when he was in Mesopotamia before he lived in Haran, and said to him, go out from your land and from your kindred and go to the land that I will show you. Well, look, that's information that we don't have in Genesis. You won't find that information in Genesis, that God appeared to Abraham. And Stephen's kind of first point, if you like, is that God, and notice that it's the God of glory, and notice how many times Paul picks that phrase up and talks about the God of glory in relation to suffering. He's picking it up straight from this sermon. He says that God appeared to Abraham, the father of fathers. Who was Abraham at that time? Was he a Jew? No. Joshua 24, verse 14 tells us that Abraham's father was a Gentile idol worshiper. So, you know, Stephen's being accused of going against the Jewish tradition and all of that. And he said, well, look, let's talk about Abraham, the father of fathers. Was he a Jew? Would you remind me if he was a Jew? And of course, the answer comes back as no, he wasn't a Jew. He was a Gentile idol worshiper. And he says, look where Abraham was living. Just remember, was he living in Jerusalem? Was he living anywhere near the Temple Mount? And the answer was no. He wasn't even in Israel. He was in Mesopotamia. We know from Genesis 12 that Abraham, and get this, Abraham was living in the city of Ur. Where is that? Well, it's 900 miles from Jerusalem, right? So Stephen's building this case. Look, Abraham wasn't even from Israel. Abraham was from Ur, which is East Iraq, which is like 150 miles from Basra, which is like 150 miles from the Persian Gulf. It's kind of like a ways away from Israel, right? Then he makes the point that Terah, his father, they left. They went where? North. They actually went to the Turkish-Syria border. The wrong direction from Jerusalem. So God says, get out of your country to the land where I'll show you. Abraham takes his father, goes north, and basically becomes a nomad. Goes north to Turkey-Syria border, nowhere near Israel, where the worship was centered around, and I love this, was centered around the moon god Nana. So it's not even like Abraham and his family were worshiping God in eastern Iraq. They were worshiping Nana. You see the comedy of this whole thing? And they're trying to accuse Stephen of going against Judaism and the law and Israel. And yet the father of fathers, Abraham, wasn't even from Israel. Didn't even worship God in the beginning. And so he carries on the story. Then he went out from the land of the Chaldeans. He lived in Haran, evidently at the suggestion of his father, Terah. And look again, this is the long way round. All right, this isn't directly across the desert. This is north. Again, between the border of Turkey and Syria. And then after his father died, verse 4, God removed him from there into this land in which you are now living. Yet he gave him no inheritance in it, not even a foot length, but promised to give it to him as a possession and to his offspring after him, though he had no children. And God spoke to this effect, that his offspring would be sojourners in a land belonging to others, who would enslave them and afflict them 400 years. And so Stephen's point is, look, when he arrived in the land, he didn't even own the land. When he arrived in the land, even his son, Isaac, and Jacob, and Jacob's children, who later then became the 12 tribes, through Joseph and God placing Joseph in Egypt and the family going down to Egypt and then staying there for 400 years. It wasn't even their land then. So that's Stephen's point. Verse 7, and I will judge the nation that they serve, says God. And that's all recorded in there in the first 12 chapters of Exodus, if you want to see that. So he's gone from Genesis 12 through now to Exodus 12. In a sentence. This is rich. And he says, and after they come out and worship me in this place. And so coming out, they're coming out of Egypt and going into this place took another 50 years, didn't it? So they're in that place 400 years. They were coming out into Israel another 50 years. And look, the thing that I just am reminded that it took one night to take Israel out of Egypt, didn't it? But it took nearly 50 years to take Egypt out of Israel because they were so compromised. And you know that experience, right? It only took a moment to save you, okay? But is God still working on you to perfect you? He is. And so God took, he had to take Abraham and the children of Israel, you know, the long way round before he would get to do what he wanted, because God is way more interested in what he's doing in you than what he can do for you. And if it means taking you the long way round, if God is calling you to something or for something or in something, sometimes God is going to take you the long way round to teach you what he needs to teach you. And so Abraham had to wait for something. And that something was actually his father to die. He had to wait for something in his life to die before God could use him. And the children of Israel had to wait until Moses died. They're in the end of Deuteronomy before God could lead them into the promised land. And sometimes, look, it's true that sometimes things in our life have to die before God can use us. There are some things that are so entrenched in our lives that God can take us out of Egypt, but sometimes it takes a little while for Egypt to come out of us, you know? And sometimes God will lead us round the long way. Isn't that what Paul talked about in Romans, about the old man being dead and slaying the old man? And how he said in Romans chapter 12, how he talks about every day we need to present our bodies as a living sacrifice. That's death, each and every day. You know, Proverbs 18 tells us that humility comes before honor. We have to slay those things in our life before sometimes God will use us. We're called to Hebrews 12, lay aside every weight and sin that clings so closely. And it does, doesn't it? And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. But Stephen's point is quite simple and quite straightforward. He says, if you're accusing me of suggesting that the Holy Land isn't all that holy, if the worship of God requires the dirt of Israel, could you tell me, what about Abraham? What about Isaac? What about Jacob? What about Joseph? What about Moses? All of these guys existed outside of the land and were used by God. All of these guys existed outside of the land and God's presence was with them. These are the fathers of our faith and spent more time outside of the land than inside of the land. Could you remind me again how important the land is? That's Stephen's point. And so he says then, in verse 8, he gave him the covenant of circumcision. And now he's going to go back to tell us the story in more detail, kind of to lure them in. Abraham became the father of Isaac, circumcised him on the eighth day. So he kept the law, even though the law hadn't been established. And Isaac became the father of Jacob, and Jacob the 12 patriarchs. And so whilst God promised Abraham the land of Canaan as his possession, as he previously said, Abraham himself never possessed anything in his lifetime, having to purchase even his own burial place in Shechem. And so verse 9, and the patriarchs, and this is the 12, the brothers, jealous of Joseph. So Stephen's kind of painting the 12 patriarchs of Israel in a beautiful, righteous, holy light. Even the 12 patriarchs were jealous of Joseph. They sold him as a slave into Egypt. How's that for a holy people? And I notice this, that God was with him. Even through that, and read the story of Joseph in the last few chapters of the book of Genesis, that God was with that man. God was with him and rescued him, verse 10, out of all of his afflictions and gave him favor and wisdom before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who made him ruler over Egypt and all of his household. Now there came a famine throughout all of Egypt and Canaan and great affliction, and our fathers could find no food. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent out our fathers on their first visit and on their second visit. And notice that. Would you just draw a circle around that? I know that's like, is that important? It is important. Everything's important. So on the first visit, they went out. You remember that Joseph, they didn't recognize Joseph, the brothers. They're like, well, who's this dude? He's like the prime minister of Egypt. We're scared. And Joseph sent him away. They didn't recognize him. And on the second visit, verse 13, Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and Joseph's family became known to Pharaoh. And Joseph sent and summoned Jacob, his father, and all his kindred, 75 persons in all. And so Joseph is important because Joseph was God's anointed deliverer, just like Jesus. That's where Stephen is going to end up. He's trying to draw a comparison between Joseph's brothers and the Sanhedrin and Joseph and Jesus. That's what he's trying to draw, that comparison. And actually the comparisons are staggering because you've got these two deliverer types. You've got Joseph type of deliverer, Jesus type of deliverer. And you remember that Joseph's brothers, and I'll just give you these comparisons real quick. Both Joseph's brothers and Jesus' brethren both said, we don't want this man to rule over us. Luke 19, verse 14, Genesis 37, 8. They both said, we don't want this man to rule over us. Give us another ruler. Both Joseph's brothers and Jesus' brethren were jealous of them. Genesis 37, verse 11, Mark 15, verse 10. They were jealous. Both Joseph's brothers and Jesus' brethren stripped them of a precious robe. Joseph, the robe given to him by his father, and Jesus, the scarlet robe given to him by the soldiers. Both stripped. Both were sold for silver. Both were placed between two criminals. One criminal, in both cases, was assured of life. Genesis 40, Luke 23. They were both about 30 years old. When the children of Israel came looking for grain the first time, again, they didn't recognize Joseph. When Jesus came the first time, he was rejected by his own people. But a second time the children of Israel came, they did recognize him. And that will be the same thing will happen when Jesus returns. They will see him. They will recognize Jesus. They will know him. Both Joseph and Jesus take a Gentile bride. Joseph married an Egyptian. Jesus took a Gentile bride called the church. Ephesians 5. Through Joseph, God preserved Israel through 7 years of famine. Through Jesus, God will preserve Israel through 7 years of tribulation. So look, the point is this, that Joseph is a type of deliverer who is rejected by his own brethren. And what Stephen is saying is that Israel is famous for not receiving or not recognizing their deliverers sent to them from God. They're famous for that. And Joseph was God's ordained deliverer. They didn't recognize it. They refused to receive him. And so the history lesson continues. Verse 15, Jacob went down into Egypt and he died. He and our fathers, and they were carried back to Shechem, laid in the tomb that Abraham had bought for a sum of silver from the sons of Hamar in Shechem. But as the time of promise drew near, which God had granted to Abraham, the people increased.
You have been listening to a teaching ministry of Calvary Southampton. more information, go to www.calvarysutton.co.uk.